When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
Every goal, every game, everywhere. The Times and the Sunday Times. Now with goals.
Hello and welcome to The Game, the football podcast from The Times. I'm Gabriel Marcotti. Now, a quick reminder before we begin, and yes, you've probably heard this before, you can catch the highlights from every single Premier League game before anyone else, except for those people actually in the stadium, simply by downloading The Times app to your smartphone. In the studio today, we've got Alison Rudd, Clive Petty, and from my secret location in Richmond, Matt Hughes. To kick off, let's start off with Everton and City.
Leon Osman returning to the side today with Gareth Barry unable to play against his parent club. Naismith, this is Barkley. Oh, look at that! Everton have the lead and a goal which will be celebrated on both the blue and red side of the city.
Hughesy, there was usual conspiracy before this game. Look, Everton, they don't want Liverpool to win the title, blah, 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 they'll throw the game. None of that happened, did it?
No, and it was never going to, really. It's just a good talking point and an extra layer to add to what was always going to be a, you know, intriguing, exciting game. And it delivered. Everton were up for it, took the lead, fought their way back, and City had to work very, very hard. And it had beforehand the feel of the game that could decide the title, and that's how it felt afterwards as well.
Clive, did it decide the title?
Well, no, but it was on paper, it was City's hardest game. If you'd asked anyone at the start of the city, at the start of the season, pardon me, if they could win, if they could beat Aston Villa and West Ham at home to win the championship, you'd probably take that, wouldn't you? So you'd make City pretty strong favourites as things stand, but there'll probably be another twist, and I'll look sound very stupid this time next week.
To give credit to Pellegrini here, they go a goal down. You know, they get the equaliser, but then Aguero gets hurt. Then in the second half, you know, Yaya Toure gets hurt. Then Lukaku pulls one back. Was it a case of them holding their nerve?
Yeah, I think so. I think he marshalled his resources pretty well. I mean, it could be argued that, you know, the Aguero injury allowed them to strengthen. Fernandinho came on then, wasn't it?
That was all the case point. But still, I mean, you're not going to be like, oh, look, I want Aguero to get hurt so I can put him on a
midfield. No. But I mean,
and he did have Negredo and Jovetic. It's interesting to me that he didn't say, okay, Aguero's off, I'll put on, you know, I'll do a like-for-like replacement. But he rejiggered it.
I think he rejiggered it because, I mean, the pushing forward of Yaya Toure has worked in numerous times this season, and I just think he obviously looked at it and thought, well, the midfield is where we're going to need to strengthen here. Our forward line, you know, once you push Yaya Toure forward, Dzeko's always a threat throughout the entire game. You didn't need to throw on another forward. I'm not quite sure how much faith he actually has in Jovetic anyway. I mean, Negredo hasn't done anything, but well, he just looks like he's not going to get another game. He started brilliantly, but isn't the guy he's called upon in recent times. So, yeah, I think you have to give him credit that when the situation demanded it, he adjusted his troops accordingly.
Alison, did he outwit your friend Martinez?
It was actually quite a close game, wasn't it? And I don't buy into the conspiracy theory one bit, but I mean, if you were there or watching it live on Sky, if you were there, you would have known the atmosphere was not normal. And on Sky, Martin Tyler referred to the atmosphere and how it must be affecting the players about 123 times. It was a really big deal as the game unfolded. And I did feel that Everton were playing the way you play when results have gone against you and you know you're not going to get what you want from the season. So I'm not saying in any sense they handed the game to City at all, but I felt there was a freedom to the way Everton were playing, and it felt a bit like it was a chance for certain players to impress Roy Hodgson, particularly Ross Barkley. There was a freedom to the way Everton played that can sometimes mean a team can absolutely trounce you. I'm not saying it means the outcome is decided, but I felt we were looking at a slightly different Everton without that sense of these points really matter. It was more of an end of season. It looks like fifth is sewn up. That's all we can get. Let's express ourselves in difficult circumstances, because I do think the atmosphere was peculiar.
Well, can I ask about that? Because I don't know if you guys watched Sky's coverage. I didn't, but I saw on Twitter and stuff that, you know, some people felt that Everton were being a little bit patronised. I mean, but
no, there's a difference between the Everton and the manager, Everton, and the players and the crowd. But you can't... I think it's easy to say, oh, there's no way the players would have let the atmosphere affect them. Well, not consciously, but subconsciously, there was an end-of-season feel to it, which is a different feeling to Goodison throughout the rest of the season, where there's been a sense that, oh, my goodness, we could make a top-four place because we're clicking. But no? No one agree with that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I wasn't there, unfortunately, but is that necessarily because they don't want their team to win, because they don't want to win the league, or is it just because realistically they know that their chance for fourth is pretty much gone? It was the same at Chelsea yesterday, in actual fact. The atmosphere was really flat, and that was reflected in the performance, and everyone kind of knew after Wednesday night of their season was probably over, despite still having a mathematical chance of winning the league. I don't think anyone in the ground believed that, and that may have been the case at Goodison on Saturday rather than any sort of conspiracy theory.
Yeah, I think Matt has a point, especially at Chelsea. I mean, the Chelsea supporter who actually wasn't there yesterday, but I spoke to a couple and they were almost convinced that Chelsea were going to lose yesterday, because they just thought...
To help Norwich?
To Norwich, yeah. They thought they were going...
To help them?
Well, no, but not in that kind of conspiracy, just because they're not... That, you know, it's one of those games they just wanted out of the way. They weren't going to try and they couldn't be... You know, the fans weren't bothered about it, so they just got the impression the team weren't going to be bothered about it either.
Are you guys okay with that? Is that fine? Well, I mean, sort of it's tradition. You get the last day of the season at home. You sometimes have a pitch invasion. The players all come round and wave goodbye. They do their lap of honor. If you have nothing to play for, are we all okay with that? That, you know, these games kind of unfold this way, despite what Sky tells us?
Anybody have a problem with that? Not okay with it, but it's kind of sort of human nature. I think there's a difference. Depends as everything. It's about context. If you're Newcastle and it's your last game at home and you sort of need a result to end the season on a high and the manager's under pressure, then you might get a response. But if you're Chelsea and you've sort of been up there all year, just been knocked out of the Champions League, and then you've almost got nothing to gain, really. So I think it's these players that we watch and comment and admire, we sometimes do forget that they are human beings, and although they get paid an awful lot of money, as I'm sure people will be quick to point out, going out there and performing every 3-4 days is not desperately easy, and there are some occasions when you just can't turn it back on.
And anyway,
one of those on Sunday.
Anyway, this weekend there were teams who went out who had absolutely everything to play for and acted as if they'd all come back from a week holiday and had nothing to play for. So it doesn't matter what your motivation's supposed to be. Sometimes it just doesn't happen.
Kai, I want to ask you to, since you're wearing a blue shirt, to become an Everton consultant for a minute, because obviously Lukaku will likely be gone. I don't think they can afford him or afford his wages. Deulofeu's going back to Barcelona, and Gareth Barry is out of contract. They could sign him, sign him in. If you're Martinez, where do you go? Where do you go from here? What do you try to do in the summer? I mean, what would success represent next season? And also, I heard some people, not everybody loves Roberto Martinez. I heard some people on my television.
Really?
Really? Name names.
Well, I heard some people on my television say that, well, you know, if he finishes sixth this year, there's not going to be any kind of progress and blah, blah, blah.
Well, if we're purely talking position or points, I guess, but there's no, I mean, there's an argument that I suppose there's no difference from that point of view from Moyes. You know, they're in the same place in the league. But there are ways of getting there that show that there is might be something in the pipeline as that team has got better. And I think there's much disagreement that that team is more adventurous.
But is it a better team minus Lukaku, Barry, and Delefeuille?
There's the rub. I think if you're gonna, you've got to find something to be sort of people to replace those guys if they are leaving, or find the resources to find the replacements for those people, and that it will take some investment, of which I don't know, but Everton's, they always seem to be synonymous with a very precarious financial situation. And so whether they can play those loan deals as successfully as they've managed to in the past couple of seasons will be the trick for Martinez. I would definitely try and get Barry there on a permanent basis if he can. I think it did show on Saturday that, you know, they took him out of the team because he couldn't play against City, and it showed, I think. Another striker to replace Lukaku, yes. Perhaps they could get Lukaku. I'm not sure how much...
Well, Lukaku is exactly unhappy there. I mean, you know, I wouldn't say it's definite he's leaving.
Husey would know probably better than all of us. Matt, what chance Everton to retain Lukaku? How much would it cost?
It cost a fee of 20 million plus, I would have thought, and sort of wages. It would be at the very top of Everton's wage scale. We'd be talking sort of £60,000 or £80,000 a week, I think, because he's had such a good, he's had a good three seasons, really, hasn't he? And even if Mourinho doesn't want him, there'll be lots of other clubs in Europe that do. His agent's pretty cute. He's already said he's been talking to Tottenham, so you'd expect quite a intense bidding war, shall we say, and those kind of situations are not set up for Everton. Everton don't tend to win bidding wars. They're at their best when they're sort of doing intelligent and quiet loan deals, and also when they're trying to hold on to their players. I mean, that's the other issue. You have Ross Barkley, who also the great goal he scored on Saturday. He's likely to go to the World Cup. There'll be interest in him, not least from Chelsea. I don't know if that might.
Matt.
Be used sort of Matt, can we type of deal? But Matt, you know, they've got keeping hold of their spot will be a problem. Never mind adding to it.
Well, Matt, in light of that, is there any scenario where, you know, maybe some Everton players that Chelsea might want? Obviously, with Mourinho, they're not going to want either of the fullbacks because they're attacking fullbacks. Whether it's Ross Barkley, whether it's Kevin Morales, is there any way maybe to package some sort of swap deal where you get Lukaku at the other end, or is that?
Well, there theoretically is, but there's a reason swap deals are pretty rare at the top level. It's because they're so complicated. There's so many different agendas, and getting everything lined up and signed off at the same time is difficult. We may see a similar scenario between Chelsea and Atletico Madrid. It's obvious they want Costa. Torres, it sort of seems to have come to the natural end of his Chelsea career. There's the Courtois factor. So from the outside looking in, it seems straightforward. But when you have all these, the players and their agents, and they all want very specific things, getting it all done is far more difficult. So while you could say that, you know, Ross Barkley and Stones equals Lukaku and 10 million, in reality it's different.
And anyway, time doesn't stand still. Even if it goes pear-shaped with the players you've listed, Gab, for Martinez, he's very good at the loan system. If the loan system still exists, he will still pull off coups. It was a coup to get Lukaku in the first place. He was supposed to be happy at West Brom. He's very good at convincing players, you will flourish under me. And now we have evidence that they do.
He has, but I see what Gab's saying. I think it's going to be a difficult summer for Everton, as it always seems to be. One of the many reasons David Moyes got stick when he left Everton was he said he'd take him as far as he can, as he could. Martinez has done very well, exceeded expectations, played nice football, but ultimately they're still left in the same situation where their budgets dictate. It's very, very difficult for them ever to get in the top four, which I guess is probably made even more galling by how well their neighbours have done.
All right, now Manchester United and Sunderland, yet another home defeat for Manchester United. Alison, should we just go and blame David Moyes for this one too?
Oh, I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Undoubtedly.
I don't want to get into the result too much from a United, from the United side, because, correct me if I'm wrong, I think this is entirely irrelevant to Ryan Giggs in the sense that you're not going to judge Giggs on what he's going to do in these four games, are you?
Now he has lost this game, and you know, as you say, we can just easily blame. Let's blame David Moyes, because nobody wants to blame that nice Ryan Giggs. But if he'd won against Sunderland after following up the first match, and by some miracle come out with victories in all three or four games, there would the clamour for, you know, oh, Giggsy's got to, oh, what a guy, he's got to stay, would have been, you know, just so loud, it would have been untrue.
Yeah, no, that the Clive has a point. It's not just if he, in the games he was in charge, we look back and he'd won them. If Giggs had managed to make United play with verve and optimism and, you know, been exciting and scored goals and looked like a proper team, and there were echoes of the Sir Alex era, but with knobs on, everyone would be saying, wow, Giggs, we can't overlook this man for the future. Well, how is he going to integrate into the new Van Gaal era? Well, so whilst yes, it sounds cruel to say, oh, well, because they've performed so poorly, we can't say anything negative about Giggs. We would have said lots of lovely things if he'd managed to inject the team with all the things they've been lacking under Moyes.
Well, it's curious because actually my friend Ned, who's a big...
I feel like I know Ned myself now, actually. He pops up so often. Does he know Mo as well? He doesn't know Mo? Oh,
shit. Well, Ned is a funny name to you?
No, I was just thinking he's more regular on this podcast than I am.
Anyway, he's a Manchester United fan, and he's also one of those conspiracy theorists. And he said that if you look at United's run-in on paper and the games that Giggs would take charge, he says that they're all cream puff games that, you know, he could easily win. And that was the thinking behind it. Now, A, Husey, do you buy that they gave him four easy games? And B, what's the logic in giving him four easy games? Because if he does really well and then Van Gaal or whoever comes in starts badly, then you kind of have a problem on your hands.
There's a sort of kernel of truth in there, and that pertains to the Everton game that Moyes was sacked 48 hours after it. The decision had already been taken largely before that fixture, and it seemed a pretty cruel indignity to make him go and take charge of that game. I guess maybe they wanted Giggs to have at least one home game, you know, just to kick things off. I don't think they deliberately targeted the fixture list and said, right, we'll give the caretaker four easy games. Man United have got far more bigger problems than how Ryan Giggs does over the three or four week period. The most one is making sure that they get the next manager right, and that's where all their efforts are going. And we expect them to appoint Van Gaal this week. Whether Giggs stays or as a coach is very interesting, but I don't think that is dependent upon how he's done in these four matches. It's all about when him and Louis Van Gaal get in a room together, and if they decide they can work together, and if Giggs will have a meaningful role to play, he's not going to want to stay there as a symbol of the class of 92. He's going to want to further his coaching career and learn things, and ultimately it will come down to them.
Husey, again, do we know whose decision Van Gaal is? I mean, is he Sir Alex's man?
I don't think anyone really knows that for sure. I think he's been involved in the process, but the difference with this time last year is that there is a proper process and discussions have been had, whereas last year we got the impression that Fergie just made his decision and almost sort of ennobled David Moyes rather than appointed him. I think this process, although it's been come together pretty quickly, I think it's been far more rigorous, and know for a fact that Ed Woodward has taken a far more pivotal role. He didn't actually start as chief executive till July the 1st. So Moyes was sort of, whilst he was at the club, Woodward wasn't actually in charge and that appointment was made. Whereas this appointment has been made with Woodward very much to the fore, acting as a go-between various members of the Glazers and the rest of the board. And I guess he will stand off all by it. He's under pressure, really. They've, you know, they've had two very bad transfer windows so far on his watch, and Ed Woodward needs to deliver, otherwise people will be talking about his future no matter how many shirts United sell and how many laundry basket suppliers they do deals with.
Okay, now, well, so I just want to be clear on this. Do you have any, because you talk about the board, can we just be clear on Woodward's the driving force behind this? I'm assuming the Glazers don't know Louis van Gaal from Louis Theroux, so they presumably defer to the people with the knowledge. I'm assuming Sir Alex, I'm assuming, would be part of the process. I read somewhere that Bobby Charlton had input in this as well, and also that David Gill would have input. Can you confirm all or any of that? And is there anybody else?
I think those are the three sort of wise heads at Old Trafford, really. But it's very much Woodward's show. I think he felt slightly sore by what happened last summer and the mistakes that were made, and he was sort of almost too deferential to Ferguson and to Moyes to an extent, and the sort of cautious, slowly approach to transfers. He seems to have been trying to be far more proactive this year. And he seems to have definitely led the management. I mean, those guys are important. I mean, Bobby Charlton, for example, is probably one of the reasons that Jose Mourinho has never really figured in these discussions, because he strongly believes in his brief that, you know, there's a Man United way of doing things, and they didn't want didn't see Mourinho's fitting into that. What is interesting is they've gone. They've gone completely 360 degrees away from sort of trying to get another Ferguson, a long-term appointment, six-year contract, to Van Gaal, who's in his 60s and will only get, I think, 3 years. So there's been a realisation already that the sort of utopian United ideals might not actually be realistic in the modern world of football. Ultimately, if you're Man United, you have to get results, and That's why these changes have been made.
It was really useful to Manchester United, the result against Sunderland, I think.
What, losing?
The way that Giggs said, I don't know why we didn't show our passion. I don't know why we couldn't turn it on. And that proves they need someone with stacks and stacks of experience and a reputation for being quite tough. It just lays out the red carpet for Van Gaal, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a good point, because as we mentioned earlier, there was a bit of momentum behind Giggs after they beat Norwich, and you had Gary Neville and a few other former players saying he should get the job, which is a total nonsense, really. You don't appoint Manchester United manager because they can beat Norwich at home. You want to get the best out there with a proven track record. Giggs could develop into that, but there's no evidence at all so far to suggest he will. So it would be a complete punt, which, given the state of the club, is one they can't afford to take, and nor should be.
And Giggs does sound like he's giving more brain time to worrying about whether he should carry on playing or not than whether he should be a manager.
Enough United. We need to celebrate the fact that Sunderland are, barring some kind of act of God, going to stay up, right? Clive, that's pretty cool. It's a tremendous, tremendous comeback, a cup final, right?
It's been
all hail, Gus.
Well, sort of. I get the impression that Gus had pretty much given up the ghost a few weeks ago himself, so I'm not quite sure how much actual credit good old Gus takes, because from that time, I mean, the 5-1 at Spurs, they were truly dreadful. It was when he came out with the we need a miracle, and I kind of think he got one, or his players just decided to carry on playing, because I'm not sure how much actual input Poirier has had in this great revival, apart from giving Connor Wickham his head and allowing him to, calling him in and playing up front. He seems to have been the spark for this great comeback, as far as I can see. But it is a great tale. There's no kind of denying that. I'm not quite sure why they were down there that far. I don't think they are such a bad team. They were undoubtedly worse teams than Sunderland in that division.
I can tell you, because there's a manager I know well who managed them at the start of the season, and he had, like 1 point from 7 games, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's why they were down there.
Mm.
What I thought was, and I actually thought they actually made some decent signings, down to the departed director of football, who's a universal figure of fun. But yeah, but the players, I think, are talented players.
Yeah.
No? I mean, if you line up with Adam Johnson, Borini, and Altidore, Fletcher, or later on, obviously Wickham, who's been a hit, that's a very good, it's a very talented front three, one that might not produce on a regular basis, but, am I wrong here, Allison? that they're actually a very talented team?
No, by the standards of the bottom third of the table? They were a tricky team, and they had going down written all over them because of their inability to form any level of consistency. The cup games, they'd lift themselves. Against the big teams, they'd lift themselves. And they'd look abject against almost everybody else. And the reason I think Clive sort of doubting what Poirier did was there were times when Poirier himself was just vocally mystified as to why that would happen. It was almost as if he was saying, I just don't know why.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
How would that go in the booth? Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.
Can't. You know, the normal rules of football, a home game against a team similarly in trouble didn't seem to lift the players. So why would that not happen? And in fact, the 5-1 against Tottenham, weirdly, they felt, Poirier said they felt that that wasn't quite justified. It rocked them. They weren't as bad as it looked. And it rocked them. And it sort of really shook them up.
In a way
that for some reason, just knowing that they were going to go down didn't shake them up. It was an embarrassment. They just felt within one match they'd gone from looking quite promising to just dreadful. And for somehow that miracle was that they just decided as a group, let's not let that happen again. And Connor Wickham scored a few crucial goals, and suddenly they can focus on one player, because striker-wise, it wasn't working out, was it? I mean, Altidore is not a great player.
I think he is a great player who had a horrible season. Excuse me, Poyet, where does he rank in the managerial sweepstakes now? I mean, he comes out of this, I presume, with his reputation reinforced, even though Clive remains a doubting Thomas. The fact is, he does have
I just think that you get the impression that Poyet isn't always... is just thinking about how this is going to affect him. And you got the impression that... do I actually want to stick around with Sunderland, or am I thinking where I'm going next, or
of course,
planning
ahead? Isn't that what you should be thinking?
Well, I don't know. Perhaps you should be thinking about actually getting this team, because I'm not sure. As I say, you get the impression there's not a lot of input. There wasn't a lot of positive stuff about talking Sunderland out of this situation.
I think, though, it might have to do with the fact that at Sunderland you have a situation where you have an owner who is certainly rumoured, or I'd say more than rumoured, to be looking to sell. You have a club that cut its wage bill by close to 25% in the summer. If you're Poyet, you know, the days of the big spending at Sunderland are gone. So you've come in an emergency situation, you've kept the club up, you reach a cup final. Naturally, you'd be looking to progress, no? I mean, Hughesy, where does he rank? Does he have a market? Can he move up to a more ambitious team? Or a team with an owner that's willing to spend more money?
Well, I think he can, and he probably will in time. I think the issue for Chris Poirier is he should be wary of being too ambitious and being too much of a hurry. His reputation is high now because he's got Sunderland to a League Cup final where they've competed well, and he looks like he's going to escape from relegation. But he probably does need just a couple of years just to sort of stabilise himself. He was pretty badly hurt by what happened at Brighton. They've been a good attacking team, didn't quite achieve what he hoped they could, and obviously ended in pretty shambolic.
We still don't know what happened, do we, Hughesy? Or you probably know, but
well,
you probably can't tell
idea,
us for legal reasons.
Probably best not discussed right over a mid-morning podcast. let's just say Chris Poirier is, you know, he's a very interesting interesting character who divides opinion. I think he's a good manager, but he's almost, sometimes he's almost too honest, too expressive. When he says we need a miracle, it's great copy, great headlines, but maybe he should be less blunt. He needs to calm down a little bit, really.
All right, well, let me end this bit here, at this point, a bit with this. Who's the Huddersfield manager right now?
Mark Robbins.
Would you swap Mark Robbins for Gus Poyet?
Probably.
Allison, would you swap Brendan Rodgers for Gus Poyet? No? Allison's not answering. You would or what? Yes
I
or
might.
No?
I might. I might.
You might? Okay. Clive, would you swap?
I'd swap you for Tim Sherwood.
There you go. All right, in our debate this week, we drew inspiration from our great leader, Ollie Kay, in his column on Saturday. It's about the homegrown rule, which was introduced in the Premier League a few years ago. For those who don't know, is that in Premier League, you have a squad list of 25 players, but then you have sort of an unlimited number of players aged under 21. But the key is this list of players under the age of 25, eight of them have to be what they call homegrown. Now, homegrown can mean several things. It can mean you came through the ranks at the club and spent at least 3 years at that club, which would have been my definition of homegrown. But it can also mean you're English, basically, and spent 3 years or more at another English club or British club. Or it can mean you're foreign and joined a foreign club and you spent 3 years there before you turned 21. And so as a result, as Ollie points out, City's roster has eight homegrown players: Joe Hart, James Milner, and Gael Clichy, who I think contributed to different degrees this year. Julian Lescott, who did too, I guess, in his own way. And then you have Micah Richards, Jack Rodwell, who were injured or not good most of the year. And then you have Dedrick Boyata, who I think played like 55 minutes. And then you have Richard Wright, who I have to say Clive didn't even realize was still playing, because he's not playing. He's the third or fourth or fifth goalkeeper at the club. Ollie makes the point that perhaps this rule isn't quite working. Allison, you have an interest in developing young English talent?
Surely we all do.
Me less so.
Yeah, I have them all locked in my basement, actually.
Okay, so what's your take on this? Should we have a homegrown rule? Does it make any sense? Because it seems to me like it's welfare for people who fulfill the requirement.
Yeah, well, there's lots of things going on here. The reason Ollie wrote the column was that we're about to hear about the review that's supposed to make English football more competitive and more beautiful and make sure we win trophies over the next 25 years. And there is a general acceptance that there isn't quite enough top-level talent in the Premier League that is English. So what do we do about that? And if you force successful clubs to have to play and deal with and train every day with young English talent, that will improve the prospects for whoever the manager can pick. I think what you end up getting if you do everything by numbers, by rules, is you get what City have done, which is they've played a game with that homegrown rule, so that it's essentially a team of the very best overseas talent, and the names you've listed, they sound like also Rams and the Dregs, which is counterproductive.
Six of them are English, to be fair, but it's part of the problem here is that Gael Clichy and Dedrick Boyata count as homegrown, because even though they're obviously not English, because of the whole thing that some clubs love to do and going and nicking 16-year-old kids from other countries, often paying very little compensation.
That's the crucial bit of the rule. If the ultimate aim is to improve the England team,
you can't do there's European Union regulation, which says you can't go and dictate it based on nationality. Clive, do you care about this? I mean, should we even be discussing homegrown rules?
If you care about international football, you probably do, don't you?
Do you?
And an England team? I think I probably do. Yeah, because it's becoming a bit of an also ran side issue to the club game, and if you know international football and things such as World Cups have to have any more standing, you know, you should care about international football.
It just seems what gets me about this is just and Matt, feel free to jump in here. I think there's a legitimately very talented group of young English players, who have all these technical attributes and skill that supposedly England couldn't produce in the past. I mean, I'm talking about Tom Ince and Sturridge and Ross Barkley and so on. And even the ones who, you know, there's a whole bunch of these guys, right? And Shaw and I'm just kind of thinking, like, really, again, all this moaning, England haven't won the World Cup since 66. You know, it's cyclical. You spent money on academies. You've got this generation of younger players who actually are, I think, legitimately very good.
It's a very big cycle, though, isn't it?
What?
That's a very big cycle, isn't it? For 1966, I mean, how small are Italy's
right.
or Germany's cycle?
Well, first of all, be realistic, okay? All right. Right. You shouldn't be comparing yourself with Italy and Germany, with all due respect.
Why not?
Because you're a smaller country, because for a long time you were isolated football-wise. Compare yourself with France and Spain. You know, that can make sense, if you like. Compare yourself with Holland.
Well, all of them are more successful than England, considerably.
Really? France?
Yeah, of course they are.
Well, France has won a World Cup, England's won a World Cup.
Well, they've won a World Cup, they've won a Euro.
They've won two European championships
in fact.
Well,
Spain have won everything for the last 6 years. I think we do, for the size of the country, for the love of the game, for the money that's spent watching sport in football in this country, we England do underachieve.
Simon Cooper disagrees with you.
Does he? Well, he's a lot cleverer than I am, I must confess. But I think we do underachieve. I mean, partly it's because the talent is spread thinly across so many different sports in a way that it isn't in most other countries. But I think England should be doing better internationally than they are. And they should also be producing more of their own players. And if we have to, you know, tighten the rules to make that happen, to create a pathway, then I think it's something worth considering. I mean, the real issue we haven't really touched on yet, from my point of view, it's not so much the homegrown element of having young foreigners to count as homegrown, because that's a European law issue, which is kind of unsurmountable. But the biggest problem is, in a 25-man squad, you can afford to carry passengers, which is what the homegrown players often are. I mean, Chelsea had a goalkeeper, an English goalkeeper, Ross Turnbull, for 5 years. He was never, ever going to play for them. He probably played like 10 appearances ever in the League Cup. But he was part of the squad, and that counted as homegrown, which is the clubs who's playing lip service to it. And it's a total joke. So,
Husey, can I just say about Ross Turnbull? We're so well connected here that our producer, Dave McGuire, plays football with him regularly.
Well, that shows how good he is, doesn't it? No offense, Dave.
Here's my thing. And when people talk about England's underachievement, right, you always go back 40 years and to 66 and whatever. And I'm kind of like, maybe the reasons that you underachieved in the 70s and 80s aren't the same ones that you perhaps didn't, you know, underachieved in the last 15 years. So lumping everything together, I think, is kind of foolish, because English football has changed and has evolved over those years. And the reasons that things didn't work out back then are different from the ones today.
Yeah, I completely agree. But that doesn't mean there isn't an issue. I mean, the academies are better. We're producing more technical players than the sort of the classic blood and guts of, you know, English.
Exactly.
Stereotype. But there's a massive problem of the number of young English players playing in the Premier League. 33% is just not enough to create enough depth of a squad. You named five talented players, and there are some good kids coming through, it seems, but there's certainly not enough of them. If there were, you wouldn't be talking about, you know, taking Frank Lampard, Ashley Cole to the World Cup, Steven Gerrard. I mean, having your key players in their mid-30s, you wouldn't be relying on Wayne Rooney when he's failed to deliver time and time again for England at tournament football, and he's still the first name in Roy Hodgson's team sheet. There's a criminal sort of lack of strength and depth in England, and I think it's partly because enough kids don't get the opportunities to play and therefore improve.
Alison, what if instead of a stick, like beating teams into having eight homegrown players, you used a carrot? You said, you can have zero if you like, but we're going to link, and this is something I've advocated for a long time, but we're going to link TV money, development money, whatever else, to the number of minutes played by English players or England-eligible players in the Premier League. Basically,
it's not going to happen. The advertisers kick up a fuss because the players that most people want to watch are the glamorous foreigners, aren't they?
Yeah, but presumably, though, when you talk about glamorous foreigners, you know, you're not talking about Bolasie and people like that. You're talking about, you know, you're talking about superstars who'd be playing anyway. We're talking about the marginals.
That doesn't sound like a carrot. That sounds like an even bigger stick to me. And I would suggest the way forward, because of the EU laws, and you can't insist that the homegrown rule is about purely English-born players, is, and it, we're just starting to see it with Roy in Southampton, is that you kill the obsession with picking players who play for top four clubs or players who've got European experience, and you look further down the league. And that you know, the further down you go, the more impressive the English-born players are. I mean, Southampton, you know, eighth place, is that what they're going to finish? Eighth, probably. I mean, you know, the only reason Roy Hodgson is considering, and Jay Rodriguez would be there if he hadn't been injured, is considering so many players from Southampton, is because they are actually shining. They are actually shining. And that overrides this bias against always picking players who, oh, they've got your Champions League experience, we can't really pick anybody else. Just open-mindedness about where you pluck English players from. And then that will feed back in on itself, because if they play well internationally, then managers such as Pellegrini will think, oh, I don't have to just pluck the best from the world outside of these shores. There are good English people. And it might help me if I base my team around a kernel of English players.
Time now for some quick hits. Fulham are thumped by Stoke and are now down. Alison, you have a soft spot for the cottagers and their cottaging. Who's to blame here? Which cottager? Magath?
No, go further back. No,
Al-Fayed,
Fulham,
Chris Coleman.
Maybe that far back. No,
Laurie Sanchez.
There is a disconnect at Fulham.
Roy.
It has been famous for being an ageing squad. You know, for the past 3 years, people have gone, oh, look, Fulham, they're producing the oldest team in the Premier League this weekend. At the same time, they've invested properly in the youth structure with an academy head who's considered one of the best in the country.
Who is he?
Hugh Jennings, who did a fantastic job with the Southampton Academy. You know, Theo Walcott, etc., down to him. So you've got a club that's a first team that's ageing, and a youth team that is improving by the minute from 2008, which is quite a long time ago now. Why didn't anybody at the club think maybe we should start integrating earlier rather than getting to a point where you've got their under-18s about to possibly win the FA Youth Cup while their first team are being relegated? Mühlenstein and Magat came in and both realised straight away, oh, the most talented players at this club are in the youth team. And you can't just prize them in, which is what they did. They just suddenly gave them first team action when they were age 17 and 18. That's ridiculous. The transition's got to be smoother than that. But that is the proof that they saw the talent was there and it should have been integrated earlier.
Aston Villa stopped the rot with a win over Hull. They're staying up too. Hughesy, there's rumours that the owner's had enough, that fans aren't happy with Lambert. What would you advise?
Mr. Randy, it's pretty clear he's had enough, because he's been spending far less money and far less time on Villa over the last 3 or 4 years. Strong indications looking to sell, and we'll do so this summer. Either way, I think it's probably time for a change. Paul Lambert hasn't worked there. It's a classic case, similar to David Moyes in a sense of, you know, man moving to a bigger club and discovering that what worked elsewhere is not necessarily transferable.
Newcastle and Alan Pardew finally win a game condemning Cardiff to the Championship. But Clive, thousands of Newcastle fans walk out in minute 69 in protest at Ashley and the rest of the Cockney Mafia. Is this sort of thing effective? And can you sum up, as somebody who's definitely not from the Northeast, what exactly their problem is with these people?
Spent a lot of time in the Northeast, actually. I loved it. I'm not quite sure what the point of actually handing over your money to go into the ground and then walking out of kind of does, because I don't think, you know, Mr. Ashley has your money. He doesn't care whether you stay or go, to be quite honest. So from that point of view, not that effective, but...
Maybe buying tickets and riding inside the ground would attract more attention.
Yeah, probably. But I can understand why they're angry, because it just, you know, if you spend any time talking to George Colkin, you see they're fairly... depressed bunch in the northeast, because they're beginning to question what the point of Newcastle United kind of is. It's just that they seem to have been in that position, 8th, 9th, 10th, on around 46, 49 points forever. And just right, their season just filled out completely. They, for a team with a middle that hasn't won a trophy for a number of years, but still prides itself on having some sort of cup tradition, and they just tossed away any chances of doing that, so they weren't interested in winning a trophy. And I think Alan Pardew, for all his criticisms and whatever, is ideal for Mike Ashley. He's probably as safe as houses, because Mike Ashley isn't interested in having a manager that might actually be in danger of Newcastle winning things, therefore having to pay bonuses or get into Europe, thereby having to spend money on that. He just wants a team that can, that he can, or a building in which he can put sportsdirect.com on. So, which is fine for them, but for Newcastle fans, yeah, I can see why, you know, they want a team that can inspire some sort of hope and belief.
Arsenal end their home season with a win as Olivier Giroud grabs the only goal against West Brom. Alisson, all this talk of Arsene Wenger's fourth place trophy earns him ridicule, but given the competition and what he's up against, should we actually be applauding him?
Well, they did applaud at the Emirates, mainly because it would have been churlish not to, because there's a cup final to look forward to. It is actually phenomenal, 17 successive seasons of Champions League football, and we're always bemoaning consistency or lack of it and the yo-yo behaviour of quite a number of clubs, and here you've got an organisation that produces reasonably high quality year in, year out. The frustration is, of course, that it feels to most fans that just a slight tweak and a bit more money splashed and they could actually get the title, and it annoys them.
Chelsea draw 0-0 at home to Norwich, and it's a bit of a damp squib. Hughesy, you were there. I guess it's not too much to talk about the game, but a couple Swarbrick decisions, but I'm interested in getting your take, because on Friday, Mourinho had a bit of a pop at Eden Hazard, suggesting he didn't always sacrifice himself for his teammates. Were you surprised that he came out in public with it, and does it foreshadow A, Hazard being sold for a lot of money, or B, Hazard responding very well and says, no, Mr. Coach, Mr. Mourinho, I'm going to prove you wrong. I'm going to work harder every day. And ultimately, Mourinho getting the effect he wanted.
Very interesting question. And it's not just Hazard, is it? He's already sold Juan Mata, the fans' favourite double player of the year, talented player. He's unhappy with Oscar, he's been left out recently. Recurring theme of Mourinho falling out with his flair players. I think his kind of tough love philosophy can work, but only in the short term. So if he's serious about staying at Chelsea for 10 years, he may have to change, because he works them so hard. He's so intense, so tough on them that ultimately it doesn't last. So if he wants to hang around and build a long term relationship with these players, he may have to ease up a bit.
Speaking of Norwich, assuming they do go down, will you miss them, Clive? And will you help me count the ways?
I rarely miss any clubs that go down, to be quite honest. They're, going back to being selfishly Tottenham, they're the sort of team that Tottenham would probably struggle against a lot of the time. So, bye-bye, yeah.
OK, Gab, question for you. And, oh, my goodness, wasn't Cristiano Ronaldo's goal wonderful at the weekend? I'm a new fan now. I've just discovered Ronaldo. I didn't know he was so good till quite recently.
It was Zlatan-esque, wasn't it?
It was, yeah, it was, actually. Anyway, but what's happening in the Liga? It's just awesomely exciting. What's going to happen?
It really is awesomely exciting. It's an absolute cliffhanger. I wish I knew. You have a situation where Atletico have a 3-point lead over Barcelona, but they play Barcelona in Barcelona on the last day of the season. You have Real Madrid, who are, well, right now they're 5 points behind, but they have a game in hand, and if they win that, they'll be 2 points behind. It's all very, very uncertain, and it comes on the back of a tremendous weekend, which saw Barcelona draw 2-2 on Saturday, and thinking, all right, our season's over, Tata Martino stinks, let's get rid of him. And then all of a sudden, Levante beat Atletico Madrid on the following day, and Real Madrid draw at home with Valencia, and it all looks special. Many thanks to my guests today, Alison Rudd making the long trek in from Barnes, Matt Hughes not making the long trek in from Barnes, and Clive Petty making an even longer trip in from where?
Sunny Stotfold.
From where?
Near Hitchin.
Near Hitchin. That's right, Hitchin. But of course, you had to come here because you actually work in this building. You had no choice. Quick reminder, each week you can catch all the Premier League action via the Times app. Download it now. You can also watch the excellent Ahead of the Game TV show. Also, check out thetimes.co.uk, which is wonderful if you don't like getting print ink on your hands. Those of us who are ink-stained wretches will continue to go and buy the actual newspaper. We're all on Twitter. Hit us up. We'd love to hear from you. Till next week. Bye-bye.
Your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times now comes with access to every Barclays Premier League goal. Refresh your app, choose your team, accept notification, and you're away.
Hi, I'm Tim Montgomery, the presenter of another Times podcast from the opinion pages called Did You Read? It's the perfect weekly snapshot of some of the best writing in the newspaper. Find out more by heading to thetimes.co.uk/commentcentral and search Did You Read to subscribe on iTunes.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.